Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, greed isn't good. Speaking at his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict said greed is at the root of all evil, and this is borne out by the current global economic crisis. South Africans choose. The people of South Africa are voting in general elections today, and we take a closer look with the help of a local Catholic priest and a political analyst. And protecting our planet. As more than a billion people around the world participate in activities marking today's Earth Day, we look at the important role played by religious leaders like the Pope in speaking out against environmental degradation. Benedict says greed is at the root of all vices and evil, both for people and for societies, and this is borne out by the current global economic crisis we are experiencing. The Pope's remarks came during his Wednesday general audience. Lydia Kane picks up the story.
Vediamo che proprio da questa radice della cupidigia è nata tutta questa crisi.
The world economic crisis that we are living through shows us that greed is the root of all vices and evils, both for individual people and for society. Those were Pope Benedict's words in front of around 35,000 people at his weekly general audience on Wednesday as he delved into the writings of a little-known author from the 8th century, the Benedictine monk and abbot, Ambrose Outpert. The Pope said that Ambrose, in a time when he saw a thirst for power and wealth, taught about greed being at the root of all vices.
The turbulence of the times in which he lived affected life within the monasteries. And many of his Outpert's writings summon his brethren to rekindle the fervor of their monastic vocation. One of his most widely read works is his conflict between the vices and the virtues, designed to assist his monks in their daily spiritual struggle. For each of 24 vices threatening the soul, he indicated the corresponding virtue that would help the Christian to overcome temptation, observing the widespread thirst for power and wealth in society of the time. He taught that greed is the root of all vices, and he urged his contemporaries to seek the narrow gate that leads to life.
The Holy Father went on to say that this Benedictine monk also stressed the importance of love in our relationship with God and that love is the road to freedom.
In his extensive commentary on the Book of Revelation, viewed as a treatise on the Church, Outpert taught that Christ must be born, die and rise again every day in us, his body. Hence the Virgin Mary serves as a model of the Church. Indeed, Outpert is considered the first great Marian theologian in the West, and he writes with an almost mystical love for the Blessed Virgin. Love, he says, is the key to our knowledge to God. Intellectual study may point the way, but only when we love God do we truly know him. Following Outpert's teaching, let us strive to grow daily in our love to God, for God.
Of the many thousands of people who had joined the Pope for his audience, many English-speaking pilgrims had come from countries such as Britain, Australia and the United States. The Holy Father also had a special greeting for the young people of India.
Upon all of you and upon your families and loved ones, I invoke God's blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Lydia O'Kane.
The people of South Africa are voting today in general elections. My colleague Linda Bordoni, who's South African, takes a closer look.
South Africans are voting in what is expected to be the most competitive general election since the end of apartheid in 1994. The ruling ANC party, led by Jacob Zuma, is expected to win, but it could lose its two-thirds majority in parliament, which allows it to change the constitution. Its rivals include a party which split from the ANC last year, the Congress of the People, known as COPE, as well as the official Opposition Democratic Alliance. The Independent Electoral Commission says it expects a high turnout. Some 20,000 polling stations are being used for the more than 23 million registered voters. But why is the world looking to South Africa today? Why is just another African election being followed with such attention and preoccupation across the globe?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that we should look at. To the rest of the world, I think in the last 14, 16 months, Africa has had quite a mixed bag in terms of elections.
Father Peter John Pearson is director of the Southern African Catholic Bishops' Conference Parliamentary Liaison Office.
There have been what are now commonly called the stolen elections of Kenya and Zimbabwe, with the attendant violence that accompanied those elections. There have been the elections in Ghana, which were peaceful, even though tense at times. There was Angola, which is growing increasingly into a democratic ethos in terms of elections. I think South Africa has had three elections in the democratic era that have all been free and fair beyond any doubt. But now, with this one, I think there's the added dimension that not only is it an indicator that Africa can produce democratic and well-run elections, but I think it's one in which the ruling party has had quite a high-profiled kind of split, and therefore the competition for votes that were formerly in one camp is now much more intense, and this could have led to violence. This had the potential for violence, but it hasn't been actualized. And that's, I think, a sign of maturity. And the world's looking to see if that maturity during the campaign period will also be sustained at the polls.
The split, Father Pearson mentions, is the reason that makes this South African election different from the previous two that were held in the post-apartheid era. COPE, the new opposition party, hewn from the ruling African National Congress, is challenging its dominance. And even if it can't win this year, it may have altered the landscape of South African politics.
You've mentioned the split that happened in the ANC. This seems to have really galvanized voters in a way. Do you think the presence of COPE is positive in a democratic scenario?
Look, I think the more voices that are brought to the marketplace of ideas when you're facing huge problems of poverty, of HIV/AIDS, of charges of corruption inciting, I think the more voices that are brought to discussing the resolution of those sometimes seemingly intractable problems, the better. So I think democracy is well served, not just by the presence of many parties. We know that that's not always the case, but that parties who have ideas, policies, contest those ideas and policies, I think, can only be helpful and useful. Yes, and I do think any party that has such a huge majority is helped by more voices calling for accountability, creativity in political thought.
Yes, the huge majority enjoyed by the ruling ANC derives, of course, from the heritage of its glorious past. The ANC was in fact the party led by legendary Nelson Mandela, the man who lifted the harness of apartheid and who shaped the new political and social fabric of South Africa. Father Pearson also mentions the main challenges faced by the current leadership, namely unemployment, crime and the HIV pandemic, key issues the ANC has always campaigned on. However, many criticise the government for not doing enough to address these vital issues. From Cape Town, Justin Sylvester, political researcher with the Political Information Monitoring Service, IDASA, told me that especially the poor are questioning their leaders.
Well, I think there are some successes that the ruling party can point to. But of course, as you rightly put out, that if one looks across South African society, largely the socioeconomic challenges that the country faced at the dawn of democracy in 1994 are pretty much still around. You know, we've got high levels of unemployment, increasing levels of inequality, although poverty in general has actually declined in that time. And, you know, we've seen this emergent black middle class, but of course the economic fruits, if I can call it that, of democracy haven't exactly trickled down to where it matters, which is among the mass of poor people that we have in South Africa. So yes, there definitely is a level of discontent among the populace, and I think that may play a key role in the election, although I don't foresee that it would lead to the ANC losing that much support, because the interesting thing is that despite continued levels of discontent, the ANC is still perceived as the party of the poor and the party most likely to deliver on these issues.
One of the protagonists, actually the main protagonist in this election, is Jacob Zuma, a controversial figure who ousted former President Thabo Mbeki and took his place at the head of the ANC. A man who has been charged with corruption, rape and arms dealing, and who has raised more than a few eyebrows in the Western world as he regularly appears at rallies and feasts dressed in traditional Zulu leopard skins and with a following of wives, hardly adhering to the kind of image we normally have of a democratic leader of an economic power.
Justin, maybe you can help us understand what the secret of Jacob Zuma's success is.
Well, I think if one looks at his career, he's got a long history within the ANC, particularly before 1994, within the liberation struggle. And I think that the ascension of Zuma had a lot to do with the discontent and dissatisfaction among a large section of the ANC with Thabo Mbeki. So I think his ascension has had a lot to do with replacing Mbeki. And then, of course, he's also very charismatic and quite popular. He is popular among the poor, is commended for being different to Mbeki in the sense that Mbeki was always criticized as being more aloof and perhaps not as in touch with the people.
So, in synthesis, there are six parties running for votes in these polls. Although it's widely expected that the ANC will win and that Zuma will become next president, this election is the biggest test for the ANC since it came to power in 1994. Undeniably, it's an important moment for South Africans who are well over the elation the historic election brought and the birth of what was called the Rainbow Nation. Today, they are grappling with all the problems inherent in a largely poor society, as well as with the current worldwide recession. And yet reports have been suggesting there is voter cynicism and apathy, especially among the young. I asked Justin if he thinks that's true.
Well, I think coming back to the numbers of registration, and that has been a common criticism that the youth in South Africa are apathetic and not interested in politics as opposed to the older generation, which of course lived through apartheid and fought the struggle, etc. But I think if we look at the number of registrations, of that 3 million new voters, 1.7 million are actually between the ages of 18 and 29, the bulk of whom are actually first-time voters. So I think the youth are now coming to the party, as it were, and I think that we'll see higher levels of turnout among youth voters, which is interesting because, of course, they don't bring the same history that the older cohorts do. And so it'll be interesting to see where their votes go and what the issues are that they vote according to.
I must say, in my conversations, both with Father Pearson and with Justin Sylvester, I got the strong feeling they were both hopeful for the future and optimistic as regards the political maturity of the South African population. Father Pearson also told me that the South African bishops have been extremely present during the run-up to these elections and have published a pastoral letter addressed to the Catholic community, calling on all to stand up for their convictions and show respect for the views of others.
The letters which the bishops have sent, there have been two letters in recent times, A, encouraging people to vote, saying that that was an important way of raising their voice in the political domain, in decision-making, that the political infrastructure in this country is geared towards public participation, and that's what every Catholic ought to do. And then encouraged people to look at the real issues on the table and say which party has not only the best ideas, but which parties have creative ways of looking at things, but more so ways that are in sync with the kinds of value-based approaches that the church has. And the church has brought to the table of public life in this country very real assets, I think, not least the kinds of assets around social health, around, you know, providing antiretrovirals in the AIDS ministry or the response to the pandemic, in schooling, in social welfare. The church has brought real assets. And the church brings the asset of also a cross-section of of the public and the goodwill of that public to the table. And so I think those are all very strong pluses that have been strong language, strong call for vigilance, strong statement around, you know, democracy safeguarded by all of us being vigilant and taking part and not leaving politics to the politicians alone.
Yes, in his letter, the Archbishop of Johannesburg, Buti Tlagale, asks all Christians to pray that these elections may bring about a deepening of our democracy. May the choices we make, he writes, bring hope to the poor, unity to all our people, and a more secure and peaceful future for our children. Final results of the election are due in on Sunday. Meanwhile, writes Archbishop Tlagale, we hope that these prayers will inspire us to move to action so that the Church can become a strong force in bringing justice and peace to our beloved land.
All people, regardless of race, gender, or income, have a moral right to a healthy, sustainable environment. This was the founding principle behind the decision by environmental campaigners to mark April the 22nd each year as Earth Day, in order to remind people of the importance of protecting the health of our planet. More than a billion people around the globe now participate in Earth Day activities, making it the largest secular civic event in the world. Founded in the US, Earth Day Network is an umbrella organization whose mission is to broaden and diversify the environmental movement worldwide, and it carries out education, public policy, and activism campaigns to help achieve this goal. But it's not just secular organizations who are concerned about environmental degradation. Pope Benedict, who has been dubbed the Green Pope by a number of commentators, has spoken out frequently about the importance of protecting the Earth's environment. He has described the need to confront climate change as a moral obligation, and points out that it is the world's poorest people who will suffer the most from the effects of this phenomenon. Kathleen Rogers is the president of Earth Day Network, and she spoke to me about the importance of this annual event and how the Catholic Church and lay people are getting involved.
Earth Day has been a major point of environmentalism since 1970 in the United States, when 20 million people came out on the streets in protest about environmental conditions in the U.S. That day spawned the modern environmental movement in the United States and was the impetus for most of our major environmental laws. And then in mid-1980s, the movement went worldwide, and it is now celebrated by a billion people worldwide in 180 countries.
With negotiations for a new global climate agreement coming up in December, what message are you seeking to send to people?
Well, this is the 40th year of Earth Day. We're launching a campaign worldwide called the Green Generation. And we hope that religious leaders, corporate leaders, and most important, the 6+ billion people that live on the Earth, will have the opportunity and the mechanisms for communicating to their governments that they deserve better than what we're experiencing now in the world, not just from climate change, but from other environmental issues as well. It has been 40 years, and you would think that we would be able to, with the scientific knowledge that we have, make great progress in solving these issues. But worldwide, it is a crisis of extraordinary proportion, and I'm hoping that Earth Day will spawn serious consideration by governments. They have a responsibility to protect the Earth and also the people on it.
You mentioned there the contribution of religious leaders. Pope Benedict, for instance, has been dubbed by some commentators the Green Pope because he's spoken out on environmental issues on a number of occasions. Can you talk to us a bit about how great a role the Pope and indeed other religious leaders can play in this field?
Well, I can tell you from the United States perspective and from the environmentalist perspective, it was an extraordinary moment in time when the Pope issued his statement last Christmas about climate change and its impacts on the poor and the responsibility of governments and corporations to act responsibly and find a solution. There are 60 million plus Catholics in the United States and over a billion Catholics worldwide. And so the leadership of the Pope on this issue is extraordinarily important. Even in our country, where secular leaders tend to be followed when they are displaying leadership qualities, the Pope's words have a profound effect on every person of every religion in this country. So he is our new green hero in the United States and increasingly worldwide. We would love him to be even more outspoken about it because we do think he has the leadership qualities among all people, and people look to him to find out what they should do and take their cues from him. He will have a huge effect on world leaders if he continues to make the wonderful statements and important statements he's making about solving climate change and taking care of the poor at the same time.
Looking, though, at the grassroots level, I know that the Catholic Church and indeed other Christian denominations usually mark Earth Day on the preceding Sunday, which has now become known as Earth Day Sunday. Can you tell us something about the initiatives that are being promoted both by the Catholic Church and other religious organizations that took place this year?
Yes, the Catholic Church has increasingly become involved in Earth Day Sunday, which was started by other Christian groups. And Earth Day Network and Catholic organizations have been working together to promote it at the individual parish level. And we have found an extraordinary interest and a commitment to reach out on Earth Day Sunday to parishioners about personal responsibility, about taking care of the earth from God's perspective, the importance of all of us joining together and protecting this maybe once-in-a-universe planet. And so it's very important. When you go to church on Sunday, you honestly do believe the person in front of you that's speaking, and that's particularly true in the Catholic Church. And in a way, it's a captive audience waiting to hear the words of the day. So Earth Day Sunday has become profoundly important, particularly when the priests are helping Catholics understand that they can take action not just in their personal lives, but also civically, getting involved in community grassroots efforts to clean up the community, but also taking a broader civic action and using that important group to contact their local representatives, their senators, their congressmen and congresswomen, to tell them that God created the earth, we need to protect it, and we have to rely on the legislators to do the job that they were intended to do.
And when it comes to the legislators, how optimistic are you that there will be real progress taken to, shall we say, promote renewable energy on a more widespread scale and to take the necessary measures also to stop emissions of greenhouse gases?
Well, it is very interesting, and again, back to the pressure that religious leaders can have on U.S. Congress, but also legislatures around the world. My personal experience is that when I walk into a member of Congress to their office, or when I walk into someone in the Obama White House, and I'm accompanied by a religious leader, I often note that the leaders never look in my direction, the members of Congress. They're much more interested in what the religious leaders have to say because they know how influential they are on the people that they represent. So it is really gratifying to go into an office and watch how our elected officials respond to religious leaders. So I'm hoping that if we go together, that the legislators will actually take some action in the United States this year. In other countries, it sort of varies from country to country. Some countries, like Australia, are way ahead of us. Other countries are only beginning to grapple with the outcome, even though they're not responsible for the causes. So I honestly believe that the religious leaders of the world, particularly the Pope, can have a profound impact over the next year, and actually shorter than a year, between now and Copenhagen, which is where the parties will convene, in terms of forcing leaders to grapple with the situation and develop a workable climate arrangement no later than December. And we hope that Earth Day next year, particularly Earth Day Sunday, will be focused globally on ratification of whatever comes out of Copenhagen. So it all sort of hangs together in a very precarious way. But we do know religious leaders can impact the outcome starting on Earth Day this year.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Do you think that in general, the general public are more green than the governments, because the governments obviously have to think about the cost of adopting or enforcing green legislation, whereas often the public are just thinking more of the ideological issue, the moral imperative?
Well, I think that's a really important question. And actually, one of the problems with governments is that they literally do not know how to figure out and internalize the costs of climate change or health issues or any other environmental issue. And so they look at the economic system without recognizing the costs associated with the problem. In the United States, for example, we are not looking at climate change. We look at it as a single issue, but we don't recognize that the toll on our country, both from a power perspective, from a natural resource perspective, from a fossil fuel perspective, all of those costs need to be aggregated, and then you will see that cleaning up climate change really is a drop in the bucket compared to the cost of maintaining the current system. I do think that people are embracing green for reasons beyond ideological sensibilities. What I'm finding is that people believe that their world will be a better place, but they also recognize that their pocketbook will be stronger if they save money through energy costs.
You talked there about how people are often way ahead of their governments and are embracing green policies. But do you find, though, that sometimes people aren't always willing to modify their own lifestyles and make sacrifices in their own consumption? You know, like, for instance, not taking planes so often, like not jumping into their car to go down to the local store, and other examples like this.
Absolutely. And the person that I start with when I'm criticizing human behavior is myself. I'm a mom with some younger children. I don't live near public transportation. Children here in this country are pressured to buy things, I think, like no other country. And I'm certainly not perfect. So I understand how people who aren't immersed in the subject and life that I'm immersed in find it difficult to be as green as they possibly can.
Nonetheless, environmental protection is a moral issue, though, isn't it? Even if that may not be the most attractive way to present it to people.
Yes, it is the moral issue of our time. There are many moral issues that we grapple with every day in our personal lives and at the government and corporate level. But there's one that is turning into the largest crisis that the world has ever seen. And the problem is, the word seen is what is the issue. You cannot see in our daily lives what's happening with climate change. Yes, the forests of Canada are being eaten by southern bugs that we've never seen before. Yes, the ice shelves are melting. But what we haven't seen yet and what we're expecting are large human migrations. So the problem for us in the United States and worldwide is that, unlike the pollution of the 70s, where you couldn't see across the street in Los Angeles during rush hour, climate change is one of those unseen threats that takes absolute faith, that people need to take that leap of faith and say, yes, it is a moral issue. Even if I can't see it, I must believe it. So in that sense, it fits so much into a faith issue, because there's so much about faith that we can't see but need to believe.
I was speaking there to Kathleen Rogers, president of Earth Day Network in the U.S.
What a wonderful world.
Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.